Showcase. Hello and welcome to Back to Millennial. I believe this is the 15th night and it is the final night of the normal format. And there are going to be four streams tonight. In 2 hours' time, it is JF Garepe, then Auntie Dem, and then finally the Christmas card stream, which will be something a bit different. The first time I've done that. But first of all, it's Emma Lucy Shaw. Emma, welcome to Millennial. This is your first time on.
Thank you for having me.
And it is an interesting story that you're going to tell here about, well, probably quite emblematic of the modern world. Why don't you first introduce yourself briefly to the audience, just in case anyone doesn't know who you are.
My name is Emma Lucy Shaw. I'm a mother, an artist, painter, poet, a musician, writer, originally from Coventry, and I've been living in the Andes for 7 years.
Right, okay. That was a bit more brief than I was expecting,
okay. But it's just fine.
All right. So you are from England and you born in the early 90s?
86 in Coventry.
Right, okay. And that's relevant because it's, you know, you are... Well, you're the same generation as me, the millennials. And I'll just go straight into the first of two questions that I'm going to ask you. This will be part of it, really. So the question is, what drove you to the Andes, or rather, what drove you away from England? And maybe things from your start in life will be relevant to that, but just tell the story in your own terms. What drove you away?
Well, I had quite a nice childhood. Like my mom said, we were upper working class, whatever that meant. But when I came to my teens, my father passed away suddenly when I was 15. And then my mom got lung cancer. She passed away just over a year after that. And my whole kind of world ended. And at the same time, there was kind of a trauma that was happening because Coventry, I remember my childhood being quite peaceful. And then when I got into my teens, I went to quite a rough comprehensive school and it just got quite violent. And the architecture of Coventry, I would find quite overwhelming. My father would take me to like the forest sometimes at the weekend. And then I felt like I could breathe. And I always found Coventry, the post-war architecture, they just destroyed the city and it was just quite bleak. And my generation, the school I went to, it like you would leave school and you go work in the car factories, but my generation, they were all closed. And there was just like nothing for our generation. And the curriculum I had at school, it was designed to make factory workers. It wasn't really designed to inspire creativity. So by the time I left school, I didn't think I was creative, even though I was very creative when I was younger. And then with all the traumatic experience of my parents dying, it was just so sad. And Coventry became very painful for me. And just the world became very sad and painful. And I had no family base anymore. So Christmas, all these things I used to love, they just became the saddest time of year. And it sent me on this very nomadic life where I'd studied archaeology at Leicester first, but then after that, I just worked in hotels. They would give you accommodation and food. And I got to see beautiful places like the Highlands, the Norwegian fjords, and the English Lake District. But I was just very uprooted and... Yeah, it was kind of like losing my family. I didn't know where I belonged in the world. And that kind of led me on this nomadic path.
How much would you say the architecture of Coventry imprinted itself on your mind? I mean, how relevant is that as the environment that you grew up in?
I think it had a really big impact, which I didn't realize at the time, but it's very, because I used to hang around council estates in my teens, so the tower blocks, but then the city centre itself, because obviously a lot was bombed and then they rebuilt it and they just did an awful job, maybe on purpose, because it felt like, because I'm quite sensitive, maybe it's why I'm an artist, because I feel a lot, I process a lot, and I just remember that just all the concrete, I just always wanted to live in the countryside when I was older.
Yeah, I know that Coventry, well, I don't know how much it was bombed. I think it was bombed at least a bit in the war.
The cathedral.
Yeah, but then the councils after the war, all across Britain, especially England, certainly used the bombing as an excuse to demolish vast numbers of old buildings all over the country.
So,
I think I've used the example before of the Bath, where the council actually wanted to demolish everything that was old.
I've heard you talk about that.
It's astonishing. And I think that was something that definitely happened in the late 40s and the 50s and the 60s, but it was still going on in the 70s for sure. So that's one part of it, that you grew up in that sort of concrete landscape. Then losing your parents, was that at the time, did you think that you were dealing with it okay?
I don't really know. After, like, my dad died first, it didn't really hit me, but then I got really terrified my mum was going to die, and then she got a cough and I was like, she's going to die, and then she did eventually. And I don't know how I felt at the time. I was going out a lot. I was drinking a lot, because I was young and I was kind of numbing the pain. I think I did, it was like 5 days after my mom died, I did unconsciously take an overdose, and I didn't do that to kill myself. It wasn't like a conscious thing, I'm going to kill myself. I just felt so sad and numb. I drank a load of vodka and I took all of her, like, the morphine tablet she left over, and I got very sick from that. It kind of scared me, and after that I kind of I applied to go to university and try to do something with my life.
I think the other thing that I would ask you about that you mentioned is, and I'm sure that there's a lot to say about what you've just said, but the other thing I wanted to ask about is the education. I've noticed this myself, that a school in a particular area will naturally be geared for the pupils that they're expecting, and also the economic situation that they're expecting, the jobs, what's likely to happen, what should we prepare these kids for. And it's a thing that comprehensive schools and before that secondary modern schools had very low expectations for their pupils and low expectations of their pupils. So it would be, you're probably going to end up working in a factory or down the mines, so there's really no need for you to know about anything else.
Yeah.
And so you end up with pupils being taught not very much. I mean, would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, my primary school was quite nice, but the area of my primary school was a nicer part of Coventry. And people would move away from the secondary school I went to because it was one of the worst, but my parents didn't bother them too much. And it was quite a rough environment. I didn't really notice hanging around the estates. I didn't notice how rough it was when I was younger. But when I got to secondary school and the kids, and obviously the trauma, they had alcoholic parents and all this stuff. And it was the school was built from scrap metal from World War II aircraft, and it looked like a communist block. So it was a really strange school. And then they rebuilt it in my second year, like a prison. the corridors were too small, so you'd try to walk to your next class and you'd get hit by the older kids. And it just wasn't a nice place. And I just didn't go to school much in the end. Like, my parents got in a bit of trouble because we would call it wagging it. I would just wag it a lot and not go. And I had a phase of being a bit of a troublemaker, but then I just kind of mellowed out and I got on with my work and I did quite well. And then my father passed away. So it's like somehow I settled down before he passed away. But
How old were you when he passed away?
15.
Right. And when your mother passed away?
18, when she got lung cancer, and then like a year later, she just deteriorated and then passed away.
God.
I think she was heartbroken.
Yeah, yeah.
Really.
That's terrible. The other thing is about the education itself. You know, I saw this in my own school, which was a middle class area. But they expected the children to be quite dull, not really interested in things.
Yeah.
So that was what they taught. It was very much optimized for that. They didn't really know how to handle anything else.
Yeah.
And, you know, people talk about this. It's a thing all over the country, really. They don't know how to handle artistic kids and creative kids. I think there probably should just be special schools for those kids, honestly. I think it's because it's enough of a disruption. It would be annoying for the other kids. Because they're not into it. They're not into art. And
no.
They hate hearing about literature and et cetera. So, you know. But yeah. Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, I remember 16, my GCSE art exam and the project, and it was the war in Iraq was just about to happen, and I felt really strong that this was wrong. I guess I started to question some things back then, and I did a whole art project with Saddam and Bush, and I put my soul into it. I really like cared about it, and my teacher just didn't care, and she just gave this kid who just copied another painting like the highest mark. And I just remember after that experience, I thought, well, I'm not like an artist then. I was trying to express something really passionate inside, and they just didn't care, basically.
Yeah, and this stuff this stuff really matters. I can remember a similar kind of thing, actually, when I was 12, just at the start of high school. And I went into, because I'd had a lovely time at primary school, great time. It was a lovely school, and I thought that high school was going to be similar. And so primary school, I was very engaged, very interested, and so I started high school with a similar attitude. Mm-hmm. And what I realized is very quickly, there was one particular class where I answered a question that the teacher asked the whole class if they knew X, and I put my hand up and said yes. And then it happened again later in the same lesson. And the teacher said, oh, he knows some names, doesn't he? He was asking about, I think, artists or something. And he said, oh, he knows some names. And I thought, oh. And what I interpreted from that, being only 12, was you're not supposed to know so much.
Yeah.
You're not expected to know so many things. So just pipe down. Now, it's possible that what he was signaling was, give the other kids a chance. Don't be such a smartass.
Yeah.
But that's not the way I took it at the time.
Yeah.
And certainly my subsequent experience at the same school backed up this feeling that I had, that they just don't expect you to be that interested in stuff. And so don't be, because it's a waste of time. Of course, at 12, you're looking for affirmation. You're looking for what I need to do. Your own sort of adult nature has not yet emerged. It's only just an embryo. So you don't have the sort of oomph to just assert, to just be yourself. You're still looking for affirmation from adults. So thereafter, I wasn't as engaged, anywhere near as engaged.
Yeah.
So that sort of initial enthusiasm was quickly extinguished. And then I had to spend 6 years at that place.
Yeah.
And it feels, in retrospect, very much like a waste of time.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm guessing that it's kind of similar, especially with that artwork about the Iraq War. Because you put so much into something, and teachers, I think, should. I mean, maybe they should prepare you for the real world in a certain way, you know, Hard Knocks and whatever. But I still think that they should recognize that what you've done. And when they don't, it's gutting.
No, and then in the art class, if you just copied a style that had already been done, I don't know, it's like original thought. They didn't know what to do with that. And yeah, so I really didn't like secondary school. I didn't do sixth form. I did a graphic design national diploma at Leamington Spa, which was because I went to quite a rough school that if you dressed alternative, you would have been beat up. Everyone was a chaff and they would pick on the one goth kid. But I always liked like a lot of music and I had to suppress it inside because I hung around with like the hard kids and I just kind of suppressed a lot of stuff. And so when I went to Leamington Spa, most of the kids on the graphic design were more like middle class, more from rural England into like alternative music. And then I had like my punk skinhead punky fate. I don't know what I was. I was trying to be part of a tribe, I think.
Was part of that distinguishing yourself from those middle class kids?
Yeah. I don't know. When I turned up my first day, I had a Burberry hoodie and like big gold earrings. And everyone was like a goth or a skater. And I just felt like I could finally express myself more because I had always been creative. And I actually quite liked the environment, like artistic environment. But I didn't like my art teacher. We went to this trip to Barcelona, a modern art gallery, and there was a painting of a red line, just a red line. And he was trying to tell me how this is art. He was really posh. This is art. I was like, this is not art. This is pretentious. Like this is, there's nothing to this. And he was trying to like make me see that this red line on a canvas was art. So I kind of like after that,
It sounds almost like a comedy sketch. This guy trying to tell someone who's much younger than him, trying to inveigle her into some nonsense.
Yeah.
So did you expect, well, I'm presuming that when you went to that sixth form, that was a sixth form college.
Yeah.
Right, at Leamington Spa. I'm presuming that when you went there, you were expecting... Well, what were you expecting? You expected that people would know about art.
Well, because I don't know. I just didn't know what to do because there wasn't any... Because my mom and dad were like working class. So the idea of going to university, they never pushed that on me. And I said once, like, I want to study archaeology. And my mom was like, oh, just get like a good apprenticeship. But there wasn't anything left in Coventry in my generation apart from maybe door-to-door salesman, which I did, or work in like an office. And I tried that and I was like, I cannot do this. And I knew that I had creative abilities. So I thought I'll just try graphic design. I just didn't really know what else to do.
Oh, sorry. That was one other thing I wanted to pick up on. Sorry to interrupt, the thing about how teachers at a school is optimized for the situation around it, for the pupils that are going to come to it, and the economic situation. But then that can become fossilized. So they're educating kids in a way that would have been appropriate 20 years before, or 30 or 50 years before. Yeah. But today everything's changed. And, you know, where I grew up, it was a town called Linlithgow, and all around it were ex-industrial towns. Towns that had a mine, towns that had loads of factories. Well, the mine had closed and the factories had closed. The mine in Bowness had closed down. All of the factories in Falkirk had closed down. Bathgate, if you you could get a job at the Motorola factory or you're pretty much fucked. So it was just, you know, all of these sort of working class towns around it were just screwed. Yeah. And, you know, you'd go to these places for whatever reason and you would just see deprivation and misery. There really wasn't much, to do. And, you know, it's a depressing thing. And it's one of the reasons I now think that we should just, like, globalization is, we should just roll back on it so that people have jobs to do, because that's more important. You know, even if it's an sort of artificially induced situation, it would be better than what we have now, where a lot, increasing numbers of the population are just jobless and purposeless, including actually the middle class, because a lot of their jobs are being taken up by algorithms and so on. And I remember being on the dole for a long time, and I went on this course. I think I might have told this story before, but I went on this course with the Job Centre, one of the sort of their runaround courses that they do to get people, ostensibly to get people back into work, but really it's just to tick some boxes somewhere. And one woman there was on this course, I think there were like a dozen of us, and there was an older woman there. I think she was 55, something like that. And I got on really well with her. And she was, you know, very sort of working class and down to earth, very nice. But she said she worked at the, I can't remember what the factories were, but she said, I worked at that factory, and then it closed down. And so I got a job at this factory. But then that closed down, and then I got a job at that factory. Now that closed down, and there aren't any other factories.
Mm-hmm.
And so now this woman's on the dole at 55, and she's going to be on the dole forever. But because there just aren't jobs for her to do. There aren't jobs that she can do. But in the meantime, she can't just be on the dole. She's got to go there's going to be this bullshit about how she's looking for work. So she's doing this course to help her get back into work.
I had to do interviews like that.
Yeah, it's a sad situation, especially for older people, because they don't want, I mean, it's not dignified. It's not nice.
No.
It's not. But so do you want to talk about this?
So I did the graphic design, and then I was on the dole a few times before I was 20 because there wasn't much work. And my mum was like, why don't you get a job at McDonald's or somewhere? I was like, I can't, no. But I'm not a lazy person. I've worked my whole life. I'd have to do these dole interviews every 2 weeks, and it just felt very humiliating in a way.
Yeah, it is.
Even at that age, like, I just, dehumanizing. Yeah,
it is. And I think it's, again, the Job Centre is definitely optimized for a certain type of person that they're expecting. They're absolutely not used to dealing with creative types. They're not used to dealing with middle class types. It's working class guys who, or chavs who might be sort of malingering, and the people are sort of expecting that. They're always suspicious, and, you know, it's a horrible kind of environment to walk into at any age. And of course then you've got the fact that some of them enjoy it, some of them,
yes,
you can tell there's a nasty edge there. So it's a weird thing. I just wanted to pick up on what you said about school, how they prepare you for something, not realizing that something has expired. It's no longer the case. So then basically you have to find your own way. And it would be nice if someone told you that at like 13, stop relying on these adults. Don't think that they're going to explain everything for you. You'd be better. You'd honestly be better. You'd save yourself a lot of trouble if you just did things yourself and found out yourself. I think that's probably what should be told to kids.
Yeah.
At 13, 14, just, okay, you've been a child, now just become an adult and just do it, and don't wait. It's a crappy situation. I mean, this is another example of how Britain is a broken country. that hasn't even come to terms with being broken. So mm-hmm. these towns are still behaving as if they've got industry and so on.
Yeah.
But then also that there's no contact with, I don't know what you might call the creative spirit. I don't want to sound pretentious or airy fairy, but we clearly don't know what to do with that. And as I said earlier, I think the best way is probably just to separate kids and give them a different education, because the mainstream are not going to want that.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like if it was a different time, I would have been spotted as being a bit weird, sensitive kid that just drew and painted all day. I feel like I would have been, that would have been spotted, and I would have been trained in that. But that never happened in this world.
Exactly, exactly. It would be a nice situation, but it's just not there in this world. Black Pigeon Pill says that Britain is a poor country pretending to be rich. I think that's actually true in a way. There is obviously a lot of money sloshing around, but it's not. It's not everywhere for sure. Yeah. And also there's a poverty of spirit, I think, in Britain, and has been for many decades. I mean, all of our lives.
Yeah.
And quite far beyond that. I mean, it's a strange, this is why I really wanted to ask you what drove you away from Britain, because I thought it would be this kind of thing.
Well, yeah.
I don't know if you want to elaborate.
Yeah, I just felt like we were a broken people. And being from Coventry, every year we would go to the cathedral, to the Blitz Museum, or this is what happened in World War II, and two pieces of wood landed in a cross. Now Coventry is the center of peace in the world. And there was just so much war, World War II. I felt like I learned about that every year. And I just felt like there was something wrong from quite a young age. I didn't understand, but there was something missing. We were detached from nature. Like when my dad would take us on holiday to North Wales or go to the forest, I would feel like alive. It felt natural. And then when I would go back to the city and the system, I was like, there's something wrong. And this mass consumerism. And then as I got older, like we just work all week and then we just get wasted at the weekend. And there were a few nights towards like my final time in Coventry where I would go out to the Coliseum. It was this club. They had like indie bands. They had different rooms. It was quite exciting. But one night I just remember staring at the dance floor and everyone looked a bit possessed to me. Just like, whoa, just getting stuff out from being like slaves to consumerism. And I felt it very strongly that there's something more to life than this. Like we don't have any ritual. We don't have any ceremony. We have nothing bonding us as a people. And there must be something. And that's like why I got interested in shamanism, in alternative medicine, because I thought the NHS treated my mom atrociously. There was one time she fell out of bed. No one found her for 45 minutes. And she had her final month in hospital and she was just scared. One of the doctors took her off all her morphine and she was in agony. And she was saying, he doesn't believe me that this is my dose. And he was really nasty. Like you could tell he was very detached from his patients. And then she was asking me I think I believe in something after death. What do you think? And I was 19. I didn't know how. I was a kid. I didn't know what to say to that. I just kind of held her hand. But the whole, like, before the Blair era, I guess my parents, they voted Labour. They were working class. The left used to mean for the working people a long time ago. And like, yeah, the NHS, we used to be proud of it a long time ago. And I just had that in my psyche. And then just seeing my mom die in an NHS hospital and the treatment she got as well, I started to question this chemotherapy treatment she was having, because if she was going to die, it's okay. Let's just prepare her for death and let's make her final time. Let's I don't know, send her off well instead of pumping her body with all this stuff that was traumatizing her. So then I got interested in alternative medicine and different ways to treat cancer. And obviously cannabis as a medicine is very good in this respect. And then I was always interested in paganism. And when I studied archaeology, I studied a lot of the Ice Age hunter-gatherer society. So I've always been interested in tribalism and shamanism. And then I heard there was kind of this underground movement of interest in psychoactive plants and how that can help people deal with death, how we're from a society. Because when my parents died, people around me just stopped talking about them and they were awkward around me. And if I brought up their name, they got awkward. There was no grieving ritual or process that I went through with elders that helped me. And everyone was uncomfortable, so I just kept it in. And then I just got more and more interested in, yeah, it's just like alternative medicine. I'm not against modern medicine. When I need modern medicine, that helps. Yeah, I'm all for that. But a lot of this is just pushing stuff on us, these pharmaceuticals and this whole system. Like it's very detached from spirit and nature.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. I mean, it's I think it's become that way. Yeah. I'm sure it always was in the duration of the NHS. We sort of seem to be quite autistic about it all now. I mean, you talk about that, the consultant at the hospital who was quite detached. I think a lot of consultant surgeons are like that, actually, yeah. Doctors. And there's a thing about them being, psychopathic, because that's how they can do operations and things like that. It's because they're so detached.
Yeah.
But there's a thing about just arrogance, consultants being treating patients with a thinly veiled contempt. I've had it myself, actually. Mm-hmm. And I understand, they feel very educated and they're dealing with people who really don't know much about the subjects every day. So I understand why they feel superior and all that. The trouble is they know about the scientific aspect of it. They don't know about other aspects.
No.
And certainly,
which is important.
Oh, absolutely. And certainly they don't necessarily know much about people.
Yeah.
This is the whole thing. There's a whole other aspect to it. I mean, we've seen it recently with COVID, but more broadly with the World Economic Forum, where there's this attitude that science just trust the science. The science tells us X. The science is telling us Y, and so therefore it's true. And the scientists are, like priests. They're the ones who understand life at a deep level. But of course, it's obvious that I'm very, very skeptical of that attitude. And I think the state of medicine, not just the NHS. I think in other countries it's similar. There's this detachment. Yeah. America's the big marketplace where they're constantly trying to sell you treatments and drugs. I mean, it's not good. It's not a nice situation.
No.
I think, one other thing I would ask about your start in life. It seems that there was quite a profound lack of community or communal feeling in your in Coventry as you were growing up. Do you think that what would you say about that?
I mean, Coventry people are quite nice back then, and we were always proud of if Jaguar cars came on the TV or the specials or anything from Coventry. There was some type of Coventry community in a way, but it was crumbling. And even within my own family, we weren't very close. Like my parents, they were really great, but I feel they were traumatized from being born in World War II, and they were quite malnutritioned because the rationing continued. And I feel, I don't know. I just, there was a lack of real deep bond anywhere. And then as I got into my teens, like growing up, I did Coventry is quite mixed. I did have black and mixed race friends. We all grew up together on the estates. And back then it wasn't, the demographics were not so overwhelming. And then as I got to my teens, loads of people from Albania started to come and loads, just people from everywhere. And everything got very edgy. And the kind of community feeling there was kind of just went. And then there was a lot of gangs, parts of town you couldn't go to. And it just became quite dystopian, I remember. My memory as a teenager in Coventry is very dystopian.
Yeah, it sounds like it. But I can believe it. And I've seen places, and of course that exactly is the point when Tony Blair, New Labour, opened the floodgates, yeah, as people say, to mass immigration. So 97, 98. Yeah. So it makes sense that after 2000 it rapidly changed. And I think that's been seen everywhere. I mean, you know, Edinburgh is similar. Edinburgh was, in 2000, was still basically a white city. Very rare to, I mean, you'd see every day, you'd maybe see one or two non-white people, something like that. Whereas, you know, now, 20 years later, it's something else.
Yeah.
But, and certainly in a place like Coventry and housing estates, it's going to be a bad atmosphere because they're coming in, they're going to have their culture.
Yeah.
And they're coming into a culture which itself isn't very friendly and has its own problems. So, and then what the thing that will unite everyone is trash popular culture. That's the only, like, you know, some Britney Spears song.
Yeah. And consumerism. And like, no one was really happy in this environment, like the black kids, the English kids, the Indian kids, like no one felt any meaning in it, in this multiculturalism that, oh, we go to town on Saturday and we buy stuff. And if I grew up maybe in a more rural part of England, I would have experienced more English heritage, but I didn't experience anything until I went up to the Highlands and worked in a bar where every Friday they had traditional music sessions. And that was so magical for me. I'd never experienced anything like that. Most of my ancestry is from up there, so it felt quite special to go. And I was amazed that there was part of the British Isles still like that. I didn't know that. Well, I probably knew, but
Scottish country dancing. At my primary school, they did a yearly thing for the older, like I think primary 5, 6, and 7. They would do a yearly thing where there'd be a dance. And I remember learning the Dashing White Sergeant, the St. Bernard's Waltz, the Canadian Barn Dance. I think that's the only three that I can recall now. And I'm sure I wasn't very good at it, but nonetheless, it was fun. And I remember everyone loved it. But the key thing here, because of course I say everyone loved it because kids aren't used to doing something like that. And yet I remember everyone really being happy. But the key thing here, because I've seen it also with adults, I've been at a few events in my lifetime where, you know, adults are doing that traditional dancing. And there absolutely is a sense of that this is something special. It's not just going to a nightclub and, you know, there is actually something to it. There's jollity. There is real joy about it, real happiness, and a sense that you're, I'm not going to say that you're partaking in something eternal. I think that would be a bit too much, but that you are taking part in a culture.
Yeah, a belonging is.
Yeah. And so I'm really glad that you saw that, that you experienced that. I remember the first, you know, I remember the first time seeing this with adults and thinking, this is different. It feels like, and I think this is the thing about live music in pubs, you know, the sort of Irish cliche of, you know, the rural pub and someone's got a guitar and, you know, all of that kind of thing. And it matters. It really absolutely matters. I mean, if you compare that with a modern pub, stereotypical, It's shitty music coming through in loudspeakers. There's a plasma screen showing some football match. It's just not the same. It's just absolutely not the same.
No, and it's storytelling too. Like, they'll tell their folk tales. And I was very broken when I went up to that job. I was homeless and I was like, I don't know what to do. And I applied for this job in the Scottish Hotel. Got the train up to the Highlands, to the furthest, not the stop before Mallaig in Arisaig. And I had a boss, I'm going to go see her when I come home. We've remained quite close. And she's a really tough woman. And she's like, I'm going to put you on the bar. And I was like, no, I just wanted to housekeep. I didn't want to have to be on the bar. And I've got an English accent. And she's like, no, it will be good for you. And I was just terrified, but it was really good. They just embraced me, this village, and there were so many characters. And then, you know, on a Friday, they wear their kilts and they have a fiddle session. And I'd have to close the pub at 12 and try and get them out. But we'd still be there at like 7 a.m., just still going. And it was a really nice time up there because I was quite lost. And I kind of felt a sense of community for the first time.
And how old were you then?
I was like early 20s.
Right. So the obvious question is, why didn't you stay there?
Well,
especially if your ancestry was mainly from there.
I don't know. I was young and I was a bit like, oh, maybe I'm going to go work in the Arctic now. Then I went to the Finnish-Swedish border to do a winter season. I just kind of got in like doing the seasons in hotels. So I spent a winter in the Arctic and it was so beautiful. Saw the Northern Lights, just snow and crystal trees full of snow. And I'm quite drawn to that part of the world. And the job there was it was pretty atrocious how we were treated. We never got a day off in 2 months and we were working 14-hour days and there was no sunlight. And eventually the sun came back after like 2 months and it came back and everyone just stopped and stared at the sun. And it was the first time I felt something quite spiritual about the sun and its importance in our life. And then from there, I think maybe I did a bit in Germany, which I love Germany. I've always found it. The times I've been there, I find like there's a lot of unresolved trauma, probably because of all the war crimes that were committed and they've never been able to look at that. And I don't know, I felt something I can't explain it, but it was quite intense for me there in a way. And then from there, I went to the English. No, there, I went to Norway to work at this Viking village for the summer, which was a very kind of ancestral, because my father looked very Scandinavian. And I was obsessed with Vikings when I was a little girl. It was the first book I had. My mom got me this Viking book and I was like, oh, they look like me. And I was obsessed with dragons and they had dragon ships. So I always kind of wanted to go to that part of the world and kind of connect to maybe my father's lineage. I know people like to say they're Viking. I don't know. But it feels like there was something there for me. And it was quite a beautiful experience the whole summer. Barefoot, I lived in this Viking tent. My job was to cook food for the staff. And you'd have buses of Russian or Japanese tourists that would come and they'd walk around. One person thought we were like an indigenous community and was asking if the government looked after us, because we did look like we lived on the land. And every night we would sit around the fire and tell stories. And then in the middle of June or July, there was a big Viking market. So people came from all over Scandinavia to sell their crafts. And there's a really nerdy side of like Viking reenactment, but then there's very interesting people there too, that quite artistic, that make very like beautiful ancestral jewelry and stuff. And I found that a very kind of healing experience, because I was starting to, through these hotel jobs, I was living in the country. I was starting to live more in nature, and that was doing something to me. From growing up in Coventry, I finally found like there was more peace in my mind, and slowly creative expression started to come back.
It's nice to think of that, because obviously, you see, what I think, once upon a time, living in a city or a large town, industrial town, it wouldn't have been as draining as it is today, as it was for you, because at least there would have been industry, at least there would have been activity and optimism, a certain feeling of strength, a certain vitality. People would have been doing things. People would have been busy. And you know, obviously, it wouldn't be the same as living in the countryside, but there would at least be a sense of that not everything's in the doldrums and a nightmare and in decline and all that.
Yeah.
There wouldn't be the despair. But nowadays, I think there really is. So I can understand why you would crave something else and why you'd want to get out into the country. But what does interest me is that you went to different countries. Do you think that was mainly curiosity, or do you think it was to do with your past?
I think curiosity, because my father in the 80s, he worked in Saudi Arabia, just in the port in Jeddah. And he's quite adventurous. Like, he got permission to go and visit some archaeological sites in Saudi Arabia that back then were off limits. And his car broke down and he had to stay with some Bedouins, and he used to tell me these stories as a kid. And I was quite, like, I was a tomboy, and I loved Indiana Jones and archaeology. So I always kind of wanted to explore and have some adventure and travel.
All right. And so you did that for a few years. You were all these different places. And then, so how did you end up in Peru?
The last place I lived in England was the Lake District, and I really loved the Lake District. And I had a nice job in this really small B&B. And I started to write poetry again, and I would spend like whole days out in the fowls in the mountains. And with my interest in kind of shamanism, and I also knew that I was still broken, like I'd come a long way, but I'd never really dealt with my parents' death, like fully. I'd never really gone into it. And I also didn't want to be trapped. I felt like I worked these jobs and there were a lot of hours, there were a lot of work, and I didn't get much money, and it was hard to kind of escape the cycle. And I felt all my vital energy I'm just giving to other people, and they're getting rich, and I have no time to figure out like what I want to do with my life. And I'd always been fascinated with Peru from a little girl because I like archaeology. And when I was younger, I used to like, oh, maybe aliens came, just when I was really young, like I grew out of that. But Peru used to really fascinate me. And then with my interest in psychoactive plants and alternative medicine after becoming disillusioned with the NHS, and that there's a lot of that in the Amazon, I decided to save. So I saved all year and I spent the winter in the Amazon. And I volunteered at this holistic retreat with ayahuasca. And this is 10 years ago. This is just before the mass commercialization of all this stuff. So back then, it was quite an underground backpacking route, and very interesting people would come. Whereas now, it's just a fashion, and it's changed a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I used to read Terence McKenna, so I'm vaguely familiar with this. So.
I had a big Terence McKenna phase too, and it was something that he said. He said, we shouldn't die in hospitals under electric lights around strangers, and that's exactly how I felt. My mother died. And I never went to festivals. I never really did drugs. I drank a bit. Sometimes maybe I smoked weed, but I never really did anything more than that. So it was just a genuine interest in trying to figure something out inside. And I heard that these tools can help you do that. So I went off to that Amazon, and just before I went, I had like an intuition, you should take some art materials. So I took some art materials and I was there for 5 or 6 weeks. And I had a very positive experience from it. It was so visionary, these journeys that, and because I had a lot of self-loathing in the past, like I wasn't very confident. I was very shy back then. So going to that environment, kind of blasting my mind, it helped me like not hate myself. And it also, but at the same time, I still was quite shy and I couldn't express myself with words very much. And I found I just kept drawing. I just tried to draw what I saw and I kept drawing and drawing. And then people around me were like, oh, you're quite good. You should keep going. And at first that I felt very awkward. I was like, no, I'm not. Am I? But people around me seemed to really believe in me. They told me like, you're a nice person. Like, I don't think I ever felt like I was a nice person. Like I was just so broken from my parents' death. And then that experience in the Amazon and being in the Amazon where it's just so overwhelming, the nature, like when you first get there, it's so loud with just all the life in the jungle and it's so green. And it was just an incredible experience that kind of it's not that it completely fixed me. There's this new age kind of thing with psychedelics. Oh yeah, it can fix you and it's in fashion, but it's not that. It just kind of, it slapped me in the face and it put me on a good path and it gave me the confidence to do something with my creativity. And I've never gave up since. I feel I was very blocked and I can't explain it. It's a shame that the people studying psychedelics are all left wing, like woke people, because I do find these things very interesting and it definitely did something in my brain and in regards to creativity.
Another thing I wanted to pick up on is this thing about traveling around and a Viking village and now the Amazon. A lot of people would say this is stereotypical behavior for sort of middle class people who are seeking something authentic, and they don't, because it's the sort of stereotype of I come from this very comfy background. I don't really know who I am. But ironically, you were in a similar position, but for real, where you didn't really know who you were. You hadn't had an authentic culture growing up, and so you were looking for. You actually, I think, were looking for something. Don't know if you'd like to say.
I was trying to find myself, and I know that that's cheesy, and there wasn't many people, working class people, on this backpacking path, and I feel like I did find something. So it's easy to take the piss out of hippies and all this holistic stuff, but we are a sick society and there are people trying to find something. And
definitely. And even for the middle class, it's a cliche, everyone loves to make fun of them. I've done it myself, and I've known many people like that. But I can understand why they're seeking something authentic, and I can understand why they feel like they're a bit of a fraud, even though they're not. I mean, they're just dealing with the situation that they've been born into and raised with. But I think everyone feels this at some level, that the consumer society is a sort of sham and empty. Because it is. It just is empty and hollow and unsatisfying and unnourishing. So, I think maybe we should make fun of these people less. I guess the trouble is that's the way they go about it.
I know.
The self-aggrandizement and the pretension of it. But you can understand it as a genuine need. Few people want to be a fraud. Few people want to be hollow. It's understandable that they're looking for something authentic. I think I wish that they could just do it in a more relaxed way. Don't hate yourself so much. It's not a crime to be to have come from a nice background, you know.
Yeah.
It's not the end of the world.
I have a friend here who's, he's from like aristocrats, and he's been through so much process of trying to heal how ashamed he felt of being from that. And I was telling him, you're from like an amazing lineage. And I said goodbye to him yesterday. I gave him my Wessex flag, and he was like, it really touched him. And but yeah, he had some trauma with his very posh background and trying to go away from it and feeling ashamed of it, when I don't think it's anything to be ashamed of.
See, it's strange to think that, you know, the working class can have some self-loathing for coming from that bottom rung of society, yeah, and the chavs, you know, below them. Then the middle class can hate themselves for being inauthentic and not, and having a very comfy background, so they don't really know who they are. But then the upper class can also hate themselves for similar for I've come from the top and and you can understand. But it's just funny that everyone, whatever rung of society you come from, there's a reason to hate yourself. Yeah. But anyway, so you arrived in the Andes and in Peru. Why don't you talk about that?
Well, I was in the jungle first for that experience in 2012, and I went back to England, and like, I was younger, I was 26, and I had this amazing experience, and I was like, I'm an artist and I love my people. We can be a bit pessimistic. I don't know if it's the weather, but there wasn't like, yeah. And so I stayed there for a bit, and then my boss said to me, I worked in this art gallery, she said, maybe you should go to the USA and try that. And I always liked the USA, always wanted to see that. So yeah, I went to San Francisco, expecting San Francisco to be like the 60s. And I got there maybe in 2014, and it was not the 60s. It was really edgy. There was like crackheads everywhere. It was obviously in decay, and I picked up on that very fast. But I traveled a bit around California. I went to Utah, even went to the Navajo Nation, did this kind of road trip. And when I told Americans like my story and I'm an artist, and they're really positive. That's what I like about Americans, this kind of dreaming spirit that they can have. And they were like, yeah, you can do it. And they really believed in me, and it helped. Like, I kept going because of being supported by these sweet, like, Americans. And then I was there for a bit. And then eventually I was like, I want to go back to Peru. And I think, to be honest, I was probably just trying to chase the original feeling of that first trip. So I tried to repeat that. I went.
Sorry to interrupt, but I just want to say on what you've just said there, that Americans have this optimism and a lack of, they encourage each other. There's a lack of resentment. There's a lack of jealousy, yeah. Which is definitely there in Britain, and I wish it weren't. And you know, people say it's about class. I think it kind of is, but I also think it's more to do with just the decline of the empire and the decline of the country. Maybe it isn't actually, because you know, you read about it happening before then. Either way, I think it's something we should get. It's just such an unattractive characteristic and unhelpful. And I think that the Americans are just much better in that regard.
Yeah, they are like proper heritage Americans. Like, as I went to Utah, I met this woman in Peru, and she grew up in the Mormon church, but she left that when she was 20, and I met her in the jungle, and her family were originally from England. So I went to see her. I met her family, and they're really nice to me. They like, oh wow, you're from England. And I just had a nice experience there. I went to the Navajo Nation. I had maybe a noble savage thing in my head. And we spent New Year's Eve there because her brother was a dentist on the clinic in the Navajo Nation, and he'd been given permission to live in an RV on this woman's land. And this woman, her father was a peyote, like, elder. So it was New Year's Eve, and her brothers, all the men, were doing a peyote ceremony in their traditional building. I stayed with this woman in her house, we had a nice time. She was a nice woman. And the next day we went to meet the brothers, her extended family, and there were these huge ex-Marines. And we had this big feast and we were about to pray. And I was sure we were going to pray to some native God, and we prayed to the U.S. Marines. We prayed to the United States flag, to the United States police. They were extremely patriotic to the USA, which was that was interesting for me. I think like certain points, certain things stuck with me over the years, and that just made me question some things. And I started to say, okay, Indigenous people, they're not these hippies. I kind of thought they were hippies. They're actually quite authoritarian. And I noticed that in the jungle when I came back to Peru, the tribes in the Amazon, there's one tribe, the Shipibo tribe, who are famous because of their ayahuasca tradition. And they have these textiles. They can weave. It's like their language, and they weave it into textiles, and they can sing what they weave. And it's very interesting. And they're a very handsome tribe, like genetically quite healthy. They had their own kind of jungle empire. And I started to notice, okay, if they were my own people, they would be called white supremacists, because they were like extremely authoritarian, very racialist, very patriarchal. And that was starting, I was starting to notice that. Like, and then I came to the Andes. Because
how did you feel about that?
I didn't necessarily feel bad or good. I feel like I grew up on movies where they're kind of like hippies, you know, at one with Earth, and it just wasn't what I had in my head of them. And I remember thinking that that's quite interesting, I guess.
But you didn't feel that it was good or bad?
No, I don't think.
Right, okay. All right, and then, sorry, I interrupted you.
That's okay. And then I went to the Andes just because of the archaeological sites in the region. It's on the way to Machu Picchu. I'm not that interested in the Machu Picchu. There's a lot of other sites that are a lot more interesting and less touristy back then. And then I found like a nice community of like fellow expats. That's what we get called, whatever that means, from like England, Scotland, Ireland, Germany, America. And you were able to rent a house for like £150, rent a huge house. You were able to buy your food for like £20 a month. It was just... it felt like, okay, this is nice way of life here. And I'd made some like nice friends, and I just ended up staying. I got a really big dog who's like 60 kilos. So I couldn't really travel anymore. The Andean people where I live in the Cusco region, they're still a peasant people. So it was the first time in my life I saw peasant society, because I had in my head that just meant hardship, and it is hard, but I'd see how kind of jolly they were and happy, and they had these traditional values, and they had big families, and yes, they worked really hard on their land, but they had a lot of time for fiestas and celebrations and their festivals, and they owned land, and they had agricultural knowledge, and they owned houses, so they weren't actually poor. It wasn't this idea of peasantry that I'd had that was in my head. And some of the techniques they use, it's a mix of Inca and Spanish, and they plow their fields with the plow and bulls. And it was just so therapeutic to be in the middle of that landscape. And I just started to think, I don't know if I can go back to England. I don't know.
And so the landscape was healing in a way, you said therapeutic. Could you go into that?
Well, the Andes are very beautiful, but there's no supermarkets. And when I first came here, globalization's came really fast now. But when I first came, there was no modern like coffee shops or anything like that. You would go to the market to get your groceries. And I felt like, okay, this is what it means being human. Like, you're not supposed to go in a supermarket and look at stuff in plastic with like scientific ingredients you don't understand. Like, I felt like, yeah, it was just therapeutic to see a peasant society dwell very peacefully among that. And yeah.
Would you say that you had found something authentic at last?
Yes. It wasn't my own people or culture that, as time passed, that started to play heavy on me. But in the early years, I found something real.
Okay. Did you feel that you fitted in with that? Was it difficult? Did they welcome you? How did you feel about being so far away from home? Did that matter? What was it like before we get to you making the decision to come back to Britain? I'm wondering, what was life like there for you?
In the early days, just really nice. Like, I met other people like me that were interested in permaculture, like creating alternative ways of living, because the system, like, we all had in common that the system felt too heavy in some way, and we all kind of escaped. We thought we'd escaped. So I met like quite nice artistic people, and the Andean people are very warm-hearted. They are not really a violent people. The more indigenous, like, they're quite a warm people, and they have very conservative traditional values. There wasn't any degeneracy or anything like that. They drink a lot of their corn beer, but I would never really see much violence, much fighting. And I felt like they welcomed me really well, but they would say they have this stereotype of gringos that, oh yeah, we trust gringos because you're polite, you don't lie, you're like good, honest people. That's their stereotype of white people. So they don't, it's not like they weren't hostile to us. Because I think, yeah, white people, we're not these monsters that we're made out to be. And just intuitively, they knew that. And I felt very welcomed. But I never tried to be an indigenous, like Inca. I appreciated their culture. And I used to go to some of their festivals and watch, and I found it very beautiful. And as the years passed, I realized, like, there are people, you know, I find all this beautiful. And I started to notice that they are an ethnically homogenous people. Some of Peru is mixed mestizo, but in this region they are mostly the descendants of the Inca. And I started to realize that that was an aspect that I found beautiful about the culture here and some of the tribes in the Amazon, that they're all from the same lineage. And so when they all dress up in their traditional outfits, they're all from a shared lineage. It just, it looked very beautiful. And I realized I never had that. And I started to have this kind of ancestral ethnos awakening, whatever you want to call it, but through living amongst indigenous people and seeing that they had that, and they seemed a lot healthier for it. Like, mentally, they seemed a lot happier because they had these traditional values. They had big families. It was interesting.
One thing I would say is, why wasn't that present in Britain? Why hadn't you seen that before? Now, obviously, the traditional values, we understand that, but the sense of belonging, lineage, you said lineage. Do you think that people, even 30 years ago, had moved around too much in Britain so that they're disrupting, you know, bloodlines and so on? Or what? Why was that absent in Britain, the sense of history?
I mean, maybe industrialization could have played a role, because I never felt that connected to Coventry, because none of my family originally came from Coventry. And I think it's the case for a lot of people in Britain. They moved around. That could have played a role. But I also think the world we inherited after the war, that we've just not been allowed to have a sense of people. They've done everything possible to make us feel guilty about that, and that's
and
wrong.
And to destroy it.
And to destroy it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess that brings us to the second half, which is what is drawing you back to Britain.
Well, yeah. And a lot of people the past few years, like, oh, don't come back, it's shit. And I'm like, come on. I miss oak trees. I miss my homeland. And I had a wonderful time here, 7 years. And I've gone quite inside, like, I've reflected a lot in that time, and I've reflected a lot on my own programming and social conditioning and living amongst another people, seeing what they had and what we weren't allowed to have. I just, as the years pass, I got homesick. I felt like I could never blend in this environment. As much as I loved it, as much as I felt welcomed, I'm always going to be a gringa here. So even if I go for a nice walk in the mountains, like, it never felt like how the Lake District felt, where I felt like I was just camouflaged and I just blended in to my ancestral land. I never really felt that here. And I tried at first, and people were like, you just need to integrate. And I'm like, how am I supposed to integrate? I can't pretend to be like an Inca, which some of the Westerners, they do. They really like try and take on this Native American persona, but I could never really do that because it felt a bit superficial. And I had my son here. And when I became a mother here to my child, who's like, he's a little gringo, I miss my mother a lot, and I felt very isolated from my people because we're very different. As much as I respect the Andean people, we are very different. And so it was just this homesickness that turned into grief for England. And I know it's hard back there, and I don't think I'm going back to an easy situation. But the trees and the mossy stones and the landscapes and the ancient stones, like, I feel I've been searching for something that was inside all along, and I've been searching in these faraway lands, you know, in their archaeology. But now it's time to come home to my homeland. And also with COVID was really traumatic here. The most totalitarian restrictions, like, they all happened here, and it was really traumatic, and it kind of burst this bubble, this cozy kind of bubble I'd been living in, ended with COVID. I was like, okay, I'm in the third world, where, like, with just recently what happened with Peru, the military just come in and shoot at people. Like, there's no, like, common law there. And with COVID, because the people here are quite authoritarian, the more indigenous, there was no resistance to COVID. People are still in two masks here. There was vaccine mandates to get into the bank. Luckily, it's the third world. It's like, it's not a really strict system here. You can get around it, but it was quite scary in a way. 2020, the military were on the streets. If you needed to go into the market, you'd get sprayed with bleach. You'd have to walk through this door and they'd just spray you with bleach. I tried to walk my dogs in like a back road, and this huge truck came and was just squirting chemicals on the dirt road. And if they caught people out, they would put them in a truck, take them to the plaza and make them do sit-ups and laps. And also because Peru was a rising economy in tourism, and that all went with COVID for 2 years. And I started to be constant. And that's how I made my living. So I couldn't make a living with that. And I started to be just quite concerned where Peru was heading. Like, how is it going to recover? Because this whole region is dependent on tourism. And it just went overnight. And thousands of people lost their livelihood. And the government here, there's no one gives them money or anything. But because they have these traditional values, they all looked after each other. So they got through it. And then this year, the tourism was coming back, and now it's just gone again with the crisis that's happened. It's just completely gone again. And I don't know where Peru is heading. It doesn't really feel good.
It seems that you found a place at the very end of its time as a traditional culture.
Yeah.
Which is really sad and depressing. And of course, there are probably going to be ever fewer such places in the world in the coming decades. I mean, I hope that this all falls apart and these places are there in the future. Mm-hmm. There are places that are authentic, pure, untouched. But for now, at least, I think everywhere is going to get corrupted to some extent. And it sounds like that happened quite visibly with COVID.
But also when I got my residency in Peru, I had to go to Lima, I had to go to Interpol, you know, and get checked in the immigration center. And there was a separate queue for Venezuelans. And this queue was like over a mile long of just Venezuelans. And the Peruvian people, and here particularly where it's more ethnically homogenous, they were completely overwhelmed. They were saying all these things that I had been programmed to think, oh, that's just white people being phobic of like outsiders. They were saying exactly the same things. Like, they're coming here, they're taking our work, they're harassing our women, a lot of criminals are coming. And it made a really visible, like, I could just see Venezuelans like everywhere. And I have some Venezuelan friends. There's ordinary people that got caught up in that, but there's also a lot of dodgy people that Peru was just flooded. I think it was over a million and a half Venezuelans they let in, and Peru has quite a small population. And their president at the time, I remember looking at a billboard of him. He was Polish Jewish heritage, and I was like, that's strange. Like, he doesn't look Peruvian. Why is he the president of Peru? And then that's how I feel now with this Indian president and prime minister back home. So it's like, it's been quite interesting, because the same process that we're going through, I've seen that this happen here to a distinct ethnic kind of group. They are being overwhelmed demographically. They're being ruled by not their own people. And there's just mass globalization. Their landscapes being turned into urban sprawl. And it's been quite sad. And I was starting to notice this, and I'll try to say it to some of my friends. But I think some expats, Westerners out here, are quite traumatized by the West, and they're quite scared to go back. And when I try to say, but with the geopolitical situation and the history of Peru with militant rebellion not that long ago, like, you do understand that you're a gringo. They're not going, like, you might be in danger, but because I think we've been so removed from having a sense that we're from the people, they're like, oh, I'll be fine, I get on with the people. But I feel like I had just a really good instinct that I need to leave here. There's something ahead. You know, they've suffered quite a lot with COVID, destruction of their economy, and then that's happened again. But also my own process, that I'm not Peruvian. And I want to go home, and I'd have people like, oh, it's really bad back there. But I'm like, it's bad here too. You can't escape. It's everywhere, this agenda. And I don't want to like hide in the Andes scared of this agenda. I don't want to die here. And I realize that I don't want to die this far from home. Like, and it's just, it's time to go home. And I want my boy to know his roots. I don't like, because at one point I was going to build like an eco village here with friends in the jungle, but then that idea started to feel really bleak to me. I would feel we would be really isolated. We'd be surrounded by, like, who are our kids going to marry? We're just going to like turn into Peruvians, and that's nothing against Peruvians, but I had blonde hair, my dad had blonde hair, his dad had blonde hair, my son had blonde hair, like all these things, that's going to go. And I actually want the real organic diversity of this world to continue, that there's these different peoples living in different places in harmony with their environment. And if I stay here, I'm just, you know, the English in the Scottish English, the British in me, it's gonna disappear.
Yeah. So that's a very, very interesting story there. And I think most people watching will be able to understand what it is that's propelling you back to Britain. And it's a lovely thing. So someone said it's about the journey of going abroad to find your way back home. And for some people, it is a necessary journey. For some people, they would feel, if they didn't do it, they would always feel that they'd miss something, that there would be a sense of an unanswered question. So, I mean, how would you summarize that question and the answer?
I mean, yeah, I had to go on this journey. I'm really into Lord of the Rings, like, as a spiritual tool. And this journey away from the Shire, returning to the Shire, like, there and back again. I just feel I had to come this far away to kind of deprogram, to find home inside and to come back home. And I feel when I got here, yeah, I had some liberal programming in my head. Oh, we're all one. And this whole process here, I realized, no, we're all different. And that's beautiful too. We don't have to hate each other, but we're not, like, I'm not the people here. We're different. Our mentality, everything, we're different. And I really appreciate them. And I had to come so far away to find what I was looking for inside and to go home.
One final question. And I don't know if you'll actually have an answer for this, but given that you're an artist, I suspect you will. What are the... Are there any mental images that you have of Britain that have been in your head that, you know, when you think of... When you think of Britain, when you think of England, what comes into your head?
Like a Beatrix Potter story of the Lake District. I know it's turned it into this romantic fairy tale, being away. It's like my parents dying with grief. You forget the hard things. You forget all that. And you just remember the good stuff. And I just remember the wildlife, robins, the mossy stones, oak trees. Yeah, just like Beatrix Pottery England in my head. And I know it's trying to be destroyed, but I think it's a very ancient land. Our lineage is a very ancient, and I came away to, and I put other people's lineages on pedestals for a while, like Native Americans and other people's cultures. And I realized how ancient and sacred Albion is, and it's quite a magical thing in my head. But I am preparing that I have to land in Heathrow and do that soon.
Yeah, well, you will have to land at Heathrow, and Heathrow is not England. But I hope that when you come back, you do find what you're looking for this time, as it were.
Yeah. Thank you. Happy Christmas.
Well, and happy Christmas to you. And thank you very much for doing this interview.
Thanks for having me.
All right. This has been a really nice conversation, Emma. So I really do mean thank you. All right. I'll be back in about half an hour with JF Garipi. In the meantime, Emma Lucy Shaw, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial 8.
Thank you. Have a great Christmas.
Okay, bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Bidding on this year's NFT ends on the 30th. It's your chance to own this one-of-a-kind commemorative piece, lovingly hand-coded by Millennial Woes himself. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.